We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a particularly unique pleasure for me to welcome to the program Joseph Singer. He is a professor of law at Harvard University and author of No Freedom Without Regulation, The Hidden Lesson of the Subprime Crisis. And Professor, welcome to the program.
Thanks for inviting me. Happy to be here.
And I want to, we mentioned this before we started this this interview, but for the sake of full disclosure to our audience, I realized in the course of my research that you were my professor in the 1 year of law school I attended at BU in 1991. You were my critical legal studies professor. I loved your class then. I'm very excited to talk to you about this today.
Well, this is it's fun to have a reunion, and it's a nice connection. I appreciate it.
Well, that class, I think I told you before we got on, I realized that that was part of my justification. I'm technically, I think, still on sabbatical. It's been about 24 years, so I'm not sure if they would let me back. But one of the reasons why I left was because I appreciate your class so much. But they only gave me, I think, 3 or 4 credits for it, two or three as opposed to the full 4. And I realized what I was enjoying was not necessarily valued at BU. But it's great to talk to you today. And I'm quite convinced that at least some of the principles that you taught us at that time have informed my conversations with libertarians, and certainly based upon your book, I think that very well may be the case. But let's start here at the beginning in your book when you talk about you are an expert at property rights, which is the sort of the fundamental building block, at least to the extent that I could get libertarians on the same page as to what they think is essential. You talk about this concept of regulations, not just making markets possible, but you can't have freedom without regulation. And you talk about it in the context at first about the 17th century and the feudalism or the feudalistic, shades of feudalism we had in this country. Talk about how that developed and how that informs your argument.
Well, it's interesting. A lot of people don't realize this, but there was a form of feudalism that existed both in the state of New York and in the state of New Jersey, where I come from. There were lords that were given not only title to land, but some power to regulate it. And the tenants on the land had to pay yearly rents. And they really couldn't transfer their property without the consent of the lord. In New Jersey in particular, when the British defeated the Dutch, they sent in a bunch of settlers, and those settlers got deeds from the governor of New York, and they moved into two areas in New Jersey. But after they moved in, the king gave New Jersey to two guys, these two lords that were supposed to be the rulers of New Jersey. And they sent the cousin of one of those guys in, and he was the new governor. And he comes there, and he says, "I'm your new governor. And all of you have to start paying rent to your lords." And the people that were already there said, "Why the hell should we pay rent? We already have deeds to the land that was given to us by the governor of New York. Why should we pay rent to any lord?" And they said, "Well, because, the king gave the property to these lords." So the settlers in New Jersey refused to pay those rents. And there was a low-level civil war for about 100 years. It was not solved until around the time of independence, and the lords lost. The settlers refused to pay those rents to the lords, and they set up their own governments. They set up town governments. They said, "We don't need lords to tell us what to do. We're going to run our own towns." And there was a fight against having a feudal system, and feudalism lost. In New York, for example, there's a statute in 1787 called the Statute of Tenures that just outright abolishes feudalism. And it says we're only going to have certain kinds of property rights in the United States, and those are rights that give people control over their own property, and they don't have to give loyalties to some lord. They don't have to do what the lord says. They don't have to get the lord's permission to use the land the way they want. We want to have independent people that have the power to do what they want. So if you're going to have the American system of property rights, you have to outlaw feudalism, and you have to regulate contracts and make sure that those contracts can't, if you enter into them, they won't be enforceable.
And I mean, and then of course we get that in the context of it's added. I mean, I guess or developed into the Constitution, into Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution. But the idea being that the dispossession. I mean, that property rights come from a form of regulation as opposed to just sort of existing in nature in some fashion.
Well, that's right. So, you know, people sometimes have this sense from John Locke that there's an empty land and people go over to it and they start creating farms. And then all of a sudden there's a few bad people that steal your crops at the last minute. That's what Locke wrote about. That's not the way it happened at all. For one thing, in the United States, you got to remember the United States was inhabited. There were people here before the English came. The Indian nations were here before then. There had to be a dispossession of Indian nations to transfer property from them to England or France or the United States. So that's one thing that we sometimes forget. But the same thing, you know, is true about the change from the feudal system. They had to take property rights away from the lords and give them to the people living on the land. And they had to abolish feudal agreements. It took a civil war for us to abolish slavery, for example. And in the middle of the 19th century, they abolished rules that said married women could not own property on their own. It used to be that married women could own property, but the husband managed it. And that was all you know, taken care of to some extent with statutes in the mid-19th century that said women get to control their own property. They don't need their husband's permission to buy and sell it. But what that meant was that destroyed property rights that husbands used to have over their wives' property. The form of property that we have today is one that we take for granted, but we kind of forget that it took abolishing previous forms of property in order to get to the system that we recognize.
And so, I mean, and let's back up a little bit here, because the idea of your book is to find some type of common framework between those on the, I guess, the from the center to the left and from the center to the right to push back against this notion, which was made popular in just the years before I took your class at BU during the Reagan years, that that regulation was a problem, that government was an obstacle, that there was freedom and government is sort of a zero-sum game. If you want more freedom, you need less government regulation. If you want more government, that necessarily means less freedom. I mean, you're trying to bridge that divide.
That's exactly right. There's a kind of strange residue that we all have now that I think comes from Ronald Reagan, where he said government is the problem. And I think that way of framing things has had a big effect both on Republicans and Democrats, conservatives, liberals, libertarians. Everyone kind of thinks about the free market as something that can somehow exist without regulation, and that any regulation comes in takes away our freedom. That's just not the way it works at all. You can't have a property system without defining what property rights are allowed to be owned. You can't have a property system without having recording statutes and registration of title so that people are clear about what they own. And you can't have a market system without having rules of the road. You need to have rules about when people have formed a contract, what are the terms of the contract, what are the remedies that you're going to have. If there's a breach of contract, are you allowed to change your mind or not? If you think about it, if I hire a research assistant and they agree to to work for me for the summer, and then just as the summer starts, they get a better offer and they go, you know, work for somebody in some other place. If I were to go to court and say, no, I want a court order for you to work for me this summer, the court would laugh at me. They'd laugh at me because of this little thing called the 13th Amendment. We don't force people to work for other people. Well, that's a decision you have to make about how to interpret and enforce contracts. Same thing with, if I buy a car and then the car is dangerous or it doesn't work, you have to figure out, well, when I bought the car, was I buying a working car or one that didn't have any warranties with it at all? You need law to determine what exactly the promise was. That's why we have consumer protection law, to make sure the consumers get what they thought they were getting out of the agreement rather than what the producer was trying to get away with. There just isn't such a thing as a market in the state of nature. There's regulation is just another word for law, and you don't have markets without legal rules that determine the shape of the market.
All right. Now, I want to double back to that notion of fraud, because I think that I think that in the course of the far too many conversations I may have had with libertarians, fraud seems to be a point that they don't have an issue with, depending on the type of libertarian they are, because it runs to a sort of a theft of property if you don't deliver what you promise to deliver. But I want to get back a little bit to the this notion of property needing regulatory structure, and the subtitle of your book, The Hidden Lesson of the Subprime Crisis. I mean, walk us through this. I think this audience is pretty familiar with MERS, which was the sort of the corporate privatized version that was set up to record deeds outside of the sort of agreed upon process that we have on the county level, actually, in states. But walk us through that, and why the subprime crisis was such a good example for your thesis.
Well, there are several different issues to talk about there. One of them is the fact that they gave subprime mortgages, meaning that they gave mortgages to people that were unlikely to pay them back. And you have a housing bubble, and it bursts, and then there's foreclosures. And instead of the normal number of foreclosures, there were millions and millions and millions of foreclosures. Once you get a disaster that's that extreme, the courts are starting to have many more issues that they have to deal with. And, lawyers that are representing people that are losing their homes to foreclosure are trying to protect people's legal rights. And so they start saying, look, if you're going to foreclose on someone, where's the proof that you actually have the right to foreclose on this particular house? If you're foreclosing on, thousands within a particular jurisdiction, you want to make sure you're not making a mistake, and because they did make a lot of mistakes in some of the foreclosure proceedings. The problem was that the banks had created this entity called MERS, the Mortgage Electronic Registration System, that privatized the transfers of mortgages. And it made it much less expensive for them to transfer those mortgages from bank to bank. And in some ways, you might think, well, that would be efficient, it saves costs. But it only would have been good if they actually had kept clear records of all of the transfers. But they decided not to keep clear records of all the transfers. And people at my school that are in the clinic and do legal services have shown me some of these records. And there were many, many, many mistakes made in those records. And so as soon as you get into court and they're trying to foreclose, the lawyers say, well, let's have the bank prove that they own this mortgage. And then it turns out they can't do it. They don't have a complete chain of title. And then you say, well, show me the note. The note is the underlying obligation. They lost the note. So there's no proof that they actually have the right to foreclose. And then if you're in court, the court is trying to figure out, what do we do here? We don't have actual proof that they have the right to foreclose, but we do know that the homeowner wasn't paying the mortgage. Someone has the right to foreclose on them. Well, who is it? What are the courts supposed to do in that situation? It created an incredible mess. The other thing that I think is incredibly important here is that the entire system, I think, was based on a kind of fraud. So I think libertarians, they don't like fraud. They think it's a form of theft. But the entire subprime system was based on leading borrowers to think that these mortgages were good for them. They would say, look, it's a low interest rate. You can pay it back. And I know it goes up to a higher interest rate in a few years, but you'll just be able to refinance. There really won't be any kind of problem. So people thought that these were things they could afford. That's why they signed on the dotted line. But it turned out they were not things that they could afford. And as soon as the housing bubble burst, there was no ability to refinance. And everybody lost their homes. And they were worse off than they would have been if they had not had these agreements. So I think there was a lot of deception that was involved in selling the mortgages to borrowers. There was also a lot of deception in packaging the mortgages to securitize them. They'd put them all together and they'd sell them to investors like pension funds and cities and towns. And then they get the rating agencies to say that they were AAA. Well, those cities and towns and pension funds, they're not allowed to invest in investments that are not safe. But if you call them AAA, people think they're as safe as treasury bonds. And I think there was a lot of, you know, they led them to believe that they were really safe, but they were not safe at all. So I think there was fraud underlying the entire system. And then you get that much fraud involved and you get all these people that can't make their payments. And their property arrangements they created just wrecked the world economy. So you're sort of saying, well, you know, what you and I can make a contract, what does that concern other people? Subprime crisis is, you know, evidence 101 that a contract between you and me can affect other people.
And so what do you say to someone who says, well, look, okay, somebody goes to buy a house, they don't understand what they're doing. How can you say that's coercion? I mean, they wanted to buy a house. They didn't have to buy a house. They didn't have to get this loan. They didn't read the document, or they didn't, you know, learn a basic tenet of that interest rates can go up or that property values can drop. I mean, why should, and this is really, I guess, to a large extent, the argument supposedly launched the Tea Party. Why should we care?
Well, for one thing, as I said, the contracts that they entered with the banks didn't just affect them. It wasn't just them losing their house. They wrecked the world economy, you remember?
Mm-hmm.
Lots of jobs lost. They affected other people. The moment our daughter entered college, her college fund that we'd been saving for years and years and years went down by 30%. So we had a lot less money to use to pay for a college education. Because the recession that was caused by all of this shenanigans, that affected me personally, even though I didn't have a subprime mortgage. I didn't have a mortgage of any kind at that point, right? The other thing is, the idea that somehow people are supposed to read 50-page mortgage documents and understand them. I'm a property law professor, and I can read those documents and understand them. But I think it's completely unreasonable to say that an ordinary person who doesn't have specialized knowledge can understand and absorb 50 pages of legalese. That doesn't make sense at all to me. I don't know how cars work. And when I buy a car, I'm really depending on Toyota or, you know, whoever I'm buying it from to make a car that's safe. You know, I can do some investigation, consumer reports. I ask my friends about their experience, but I really am depending on them to make a car that's going to work, that's not going to kill me or my children, it's not going to be unsafe for other people. I depend on them to do a good job on that. And the same thing's true with those mortgages. I think people trusted the banks when they went in there and said, you know, I want to get a mortgage that will let me get a house. And the bank said, yeah, this one's good for you. I think that at that point, it's not really the homeowner who's saying, you know, look, I want to gamble. It's like I'm going to Las Vegas and I'm gambling. They weren't trying to gamble. They were trying to buy a house. There were some people that were buying houses to speculate, but the millions and millions of people, the unbelievable vast majority, were just trying to buy a house. And the bank really has to be careful, to make arrangements that are actually appropriate for people. And I think people have the right to trust people that they contract with in the marketplace. That's part of why I think libertarians should be on board with preventing deception. I think there was deception in the marketing of the mortgages. And I think the banks are the ones that have the ability and the obligation to stop, to not engage in deception when they're talking to potential buyers.
But now, continuing to sort of play devil's advocate here, if what they were doing was committing fraud, there's already fraud books, laws on the books. I mean, where does regulation come in here? In terms of bridging that divide to libertarians. I mean, I would add, like, just also using your car analogy, it is one thing to say that, Toyota has to be truthful when they say to me, this car is safe. But when we talk about regulation, we're not just talking about they need to be truthful. We're also saying that the government's going to require Toyota to put airbags in, let's say, or seatbelts, and they're going to require that of everyone. Why not just let Toyota make the case to me that this car is going to be safe even without airbags, let's say?
Well, because it's not. We know this, right? The cars are not safe without airbags, and the car companies wanted to sell cars without airbags, and a lot of people died because of it. Right. So,
well, but people die.
Argue that it's safe, but,
people die. 50,000 people die on the highways. Every year with airbags. Why can't you let the consumer make that decision? I would prefer to pay less for this Toyota because it has no airbags.
Well, let's think about that. If you take the argument that we don't want any kind of regulation at all. Think about building codes. Every single state has laws that regulate construction to make sure that houses are built in a safe manner. I kind of like those laws. My brother's house burned down because the prior owner did his own electrical work and didn't know what he was doing. And the fire started right outside the bedroom of my niece. And luckily, they were not in the house. If they'd been in the house, she wouldn't be alive today. We have regulation of building construction. You have to be a licensed electrician to put the electricity into the house. And that is something that makes houses safe for all of us. It's true that it increases the cost of housing. And because people's incomes are too low today, that actually means that low-income people have a lot of trouble finding affordable housing. But I think the way we help poor people is not by making housing unsafe for the rest of us.
Well, that is sort of the other aspect. I mean, you look at it in terms of the minimum wage. I mean, this is where I think you have the biggest challenge in terms of trying to convince libertarians, because ostensibly the problem with the minimum wage, for instance, law is that it's going to reduce employment. So you are preventing people, low-income people, from getting a job, even though it may be worthwhile to them. I had a libertarian professor from a business school argue to me that one is better than nothing, and $1 is better than $0. And you are preventing someone from selling their labor at a price where they could get a job. You're preventing them from doing that by requiring a company, let's say, to pay whatever, $12, $7.25, $15 in some states in the future. What is the response to that infringement on the contract via, I guess, regulation?
Well, we used to have no laws about that, and it was called feudalism and slavery. It used to be that people would be on the Lord's land doing work for him. That's Downton Abbey, right? It's sort of, you're part of the household, and you actually do the work, and you don't get any pay. That wasn't a form of life that we wanted in the United States. One of the things that we have to remember is usually when people say, well, if you change the minimum wage law, then it has a bad effect. That is really an argument for getting rid of the minimum wage law entirely. And if you keep going back, it's an argument for getting rid of all the regulations we have, which is an argument for getting rid of all the laws that we have. And, so why have laws against even fraud? Why not let people caveat emptor, let the buyer beware? Libertarians, if they really want no laws at all, then you have to let people engage in fraud as well. If you look in terms of evidence, though, in terms of the laws that we have, we actually have lots of laws in the states, including in the most libertarian states you can imagine. We have environmental law, we have zoning law, we have banking law, we have insurance regulation law, we have consumer protection law, we have marriage law, obviously. The American people don't want no law. They don't want to live in a state of nature. They don't want to live in a war zone. There are places in the world that don't have law, and I feel lucky that I don't live there, right? Just to be conservative is the one at law and order. This idea that somehow all regulations are bad would mean, okay, get rid of all the laws that we have. Nobody wants that. Libertarians don't want that either. It's kind of striking when you think about it. Most people think zoning law protects their property rights. Well, zoning is a pretty strong form of regulation, and in a lot of ways it has the effect of making it impossible to create low-income housing. But zoning is something that a lot of people want because they know that the value of their property is protected by not having incompatible uses next door. Again, look at Texas or Idaho or any state that seems more libertarian. They have a lot of laws on the books that are intended to protect people from harm and to make sure when they go into the consumer marketplace that people don't cheat them.
I just want to quote you in terms of that property rights. You write, it's surprisingly easy to forget that property rights are not merely individual entitlements, but a system that requires the rights of each to be compatible with the rights of others. And I've heard you talk about a law, a zoning law, I think it was from Seattle, and use the example of I think it was a mortuary. Would you, if you recall that example, would you talk about it now? Because I found it to be very a very clear example of how property rights and any regulation or lack of regulation, either way you cut it, there is a sort of a taking of some way. I mean, is that fair to say? I mean,
I completely agree. There's no way to have property without kind of rules about what you're allowed to do with it. And however you have the law, however you change the law, you're creating and redistributing rights. There used to be no zoning law, but there's zoning law almost everywhere. Houston doesn't have it, but every other place has it. And people in the United States like zoning law. They really, really like it. If they didn't like it, they could get rid of it. You know, we do elect people and they pass the zoning laws. People want zoning law. But on the other hand, they do complain that, if a change in the zoning law says you cannot do something you used to be able to do, no one likes being told they can't do something. So what happened in Oregon was that there were some people that were upset that there were certain changes in zoning law happening that prevented them from building property that they wanted to build. So they said, well, let's go back and say, well, keep the zoning laws that we have. So that's kind of important. They didn't abolish all the zoning law. They said, let's keep the zoning law that we have. And any new zoning law that further restricts your use of property cannot be enforced against you unless they compensate you for the loss of your property rights. And then they did this.
Let me just explain that concept. So any law, any zoning law that in any way reduces the value of your property by 1 cent because it restricts the way that you can use it, I guess, or because
if it used to be that you could build two stories and they changed the law to say you can only build one story, for example.
Okay. Okay.
So any new restriction like that that says you do less on your property, you had to compensate the person. But then what they said is any new restriction on you or your father or your grandfather. So the zoning laws that were in effect depended on when your family moved there. So on one street, someone might be subject to the zoning law of 2005, and someone else might be the zoning law of 1990. And if someone was there, you know, for 100 years, there was no zoning law in 1900, and your lot might be subject to no zoning law at all.
So you get so grandfathered was, in into a state of
right,
nature.
You're really grandfathered in, right? So what that meant was all of a sudden, someone who is property restricted to single-family house use is living next to someone that has no limits at all. So they decided to put in a gas station. And it's the middle of a residential neighborhood, and there's going to be a gas station next door. So people don't want the gas station next door. The gas station reduces the value of your property by 50%. So what this meant was people experienced for the first time that a deregulation of someone else's property might hurt the market value of your property and make your life more uncomfortable.
And
so they had a new initiative, and they substantially repealed that law.
And so and it's this dynamic of deregulation actually impinging, because the argument we hear, right, is that your rights stop at the edge of my nose. And the arguments that I often have with libertarians is that there should be no sort of strict environmental laws or, you know, anything that I do on my property doesn't necessarily inhibit you. But there is no, I mean, there is no way to contain, essentially, in our interconnected society, what you do on your property, not in any way inhibiting my enjoyment of my property or just my enjoyment of my life or liberty, per se.
Well, obviously, you know, think about a factory that pollutes. Obviously, that affects your life as well as your property. And they're not doing anything on your land, but the pollution substantially affects your land. That's why Americans actually are in favor of environmental law. And same thing, think about low-income housing. If you're in a single-family neighborhood and some churches get together and they want to build multifamily housing, there are a lot of situations that we face in the country where the neighbors say, NIMBY, not in my backyard. I don't want that multifamily housing here because it's going to reduce the value of my property. And, you know, that's a situation where people are asking for regulation because they think it's going to protect their property rights. It's not a situation where they think regulation takes away their property. Now, in fact, you want to have, you know, appropriate regulations so that you can have housing that's affordable by everyone. And that's why you need to have an appropriate zoning structure that allows housing for the poorest people as well as the richest people.
And even if you are one of those people who don't want regulations to provide housing for everyone, at the very least, you have to concede that regulations work both ways, that there is no notion that regulations are necessarily a taking. Regulations can be used to enhance or decrease your own personal value one way or another. I mean, talk about, just lastly, because I know you've written about this, is this concept of me as a baker, and I don't want to sell you a wedding cake for your wedding because your wedding represents an offense to my religious or other sensibilities in some way. Talk about this notion of why commerce, once you decide to open up commerce to the public, you are obligated to open it up to everyone.
Well, think about the function of public accommodations in general in our country. If you were African-American and traveling in the South in the 1950s, what you had to do was to pack a really big picnic to come with you in the car, because you might not necessarily find any restaurant that would let you eat there. You might have to call ahead to find friends where you can sleep, because hotels might not let you book a room. You know, if people, if the marketplace for public accommodations is not open to people, then your freedom to travel is limited. I grew up in New Jersey because I'm Jewish, and my father could not find a job in New York City because they were discriminating against Jewish engineers. I grew up in New Jersey because the Fort Monmouth, the federal government, they hired Jewish engineers. Bell Laboratories hired Jewish engineers. So our family was kind of evicted from New York because my father couldn't find a job. We had to go to a place where he was able to enter into the marketplace. Property rights are about the right to control your property, but property rights are also about the right to acquire property. If no one's going to let me in the store, then I can't buy a shirt. If people aren't going to rent to me because of my race, then I can't find an apartment. And the stuff about the bakers, you know, it's true you have religious freedom. And that means you get to go to church. It means you get to believe what you want. It means in your church, in your home, you get to exclude people that don't agree with your religion. But if you're in commerce and you're open to the general public, then you're entering a world where people have a right of access to employment and housing and public accommodations without regard to race or sex or sexual orientation or religion. Just imagine a store that wouldn't serve someone because they were a Christian. Christians would be very upset about that, I believe. And we have to think about it both ways. If you think they should serve you because you're a Christian, you can't refuse to serve someone else because of their religious practice. The other aspect of this is that people sometimes think religion is just on the side of the baker that wants to exclude same-sex couples. But same-sex couples have religion as well. There's religious interest on both sides. And the right way to protect religious freedom is to allow people to have freedom within their own churches and synagogues, within their own belief, within their own private arrangements. But in the public world of the market, public accommodations, employment, and housing, as I said before at the very beginning, we don't have titles of nobility in the United States. That means we do not have a caste system. You're not excluded from the marketplace because of your race. You're not excluded because of your sex. And these days, when we look at how we want things to be arranged, we don't want to prevent people from entering the marketplace because of their sexual orientation either.
And in fact, 25 states are around the country, and in terms of federally, there's an absence of any sort of a compulsion when it comes to employment and accommodation, for that matter. If you are gay or transgender, you have, in about half the states in the country, is my understanding, you have no right to keep your job. As a gay person, you can be fired because you're gay.
And you have no right to housing. You have no right to go into a store. You have no right. I mean, you just never know from moment to moment whether you're going to be thrown out, whether someone's going to say, we don't serve people of your kind. It's just, it makes life completely tenuous and uncertain and dangerous.
And, you know, it's also, I guess, a walking testament, because I hear quite often from libertarians in terms of those who would take issue with the Civil Rights Act, or the you know, one could say, like, oh, I could deny Christians service at my restaurant, but I'm going to be out of business very soon. Well, this example of being able to deny service to lesbian, gay, or transgender folks, I think it's indicative of that. It doesn't necessarily mean you're going to go out of business. I mean, sadly, I think in some places in this country, it could be a selling point. I mean, we certainly see that in some instances. I think, you know, where we see this, we see bigotry sometimes is rewarded in the marketplace, sadly.
Well, this was clearly an issue in the South and, you know, around in the 1960s. Where, in fact, there were some businesses that wanted not to discriminate, but they would have gone out of business if they hadn't operated segregated businesses. the loss of income would have been greater than the income they would have gotten if they had allowed African Americans to eat in an integrated setting. I sometimes also hear the argument that, just go to another florist. Who cares about whether you get it from this particular florist? Well, I grew up in a small town, and there was a florist. The florist was the florist. The idea that you go to a different florist, that makes sense if you're in Boston or New York or some, Denver, someplace that has a lot of florists. Small town that has 2,000 people, not clear that you're going to find someone else that is going to serve you. And the idea that if you're in a place where lots of people have the same religious beliefs, and nobody has to make it possible for you to live, nobody has to make it possible for you to buy food or clothing or rent you an apartment, really, that's an order evicting you from the town, and that's un-American.
No freedom without regulation, the hidden lesson of the subprime crisis. Joseph Singer, thank you so much for your time today. We will link to your book at majority.fm. Really appreciate your time.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thanks for inviting me.